In stark reality is surprising. Seeing the details of NSA programs, of FBI collection programs, of these license plate capture programs, or what the data brokers know, the sheer detail, I think, is surprising. Because while we recognize this data is being collected, we often don't understand the analysis. And that, I think, surprises most people. That surprised me.
Do you think political liberty and justice are threatened?
I think they are. I think we're living in a world where we are being judged by our data. We're being judged in secret, where there are effectively secret courts. I mean, if you can't fly an airplane, you can't figure out why you can't or how to redress that. If you're denied for a mortgage or possibly a job, it could be because of this data. And you can't face your accuser and try to protect yourself. These are extraordinary times, and I think the threats are great because algorithms are making decisions, not people, and that's very dangerous.
Well, Bruce Schneier, we're going to continue our conversation outside of this broadcast and post it online at democracynow.org, particularly how people can protect themselves. Bruce Schneier is a security technologist. His latest book, Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. He's a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And that does it for our broadcast. A very happy birthday to Aaron Maté. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Maté, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alfa, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
It takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. KBOO is your radio station. Did you know that you can give gifts of stock to KBOO? We are able to quickly turn these donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? Call 503-231-8032, extension 201, or email monica@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
Tune in to KBOO every second Friday from 8 to 10 p.m. for 1212, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective. We'll be jamming out to hip-hop and its evolutionary influences for higher vibrations and a peaceful tomorrow. We'll be dropping some cold classics by Bobby Humphrey, Gil Scott-Heron, and Zane, as well as some newer jams. Again, that's 1212, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective, every second Friday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland high schooler Tiger Rooley is acquitted of all charges against him.
Oregon snowpack hits a record low for this last winter.
Oregon authorities have held a man as material witness for nearly 900 days, setting a national record for the holding of a witness without charges.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 13th, 2015. I'm Robert Parncore.
And I'm Liam Delta. Multnomah County Judge Diana Stewart yesterday dropped all charges filed against 16-year-old Tiger Rooley in a case involving a violent struggle with three police officers last year in North Portland. Rooley, a sophomore at Roosevelt High School, was found not guilty of resisting arrest nor of assaulting or strangling a police officer. In a 15-minute strongly worded pronouncement, Judge Stewart harshly reprimanded the police officers involved. She said they put Garuli at serious risk of injury in a melee of fists and punches and bodies falling upon him. The officers are not being charged with any legal misconduct. However, the judge's criticism of their handling of the situation resonated with many in the Portland community. Gruley was with his older brother and a friend when he was stopped by Officer Betsy Hornstein in a stop previously ruled unlawful by the judge. Two more officers showed up and tried to handcuff Gruley, at which time he tensed up and officers began forcing him to the ground. As Gruley struggled against the officers, he was kneed, punched, had his hair pulled, and was ultimately tasered by one of the officers. The incident was caught on video by two bystanders. The video shows the officers clearly using unnecessary levels of force. The judge also criticized Officer Hornstein for testifying inaccurately about the events. Hornstein said she was punched in the eye by Gruley and that he tried to choke her twice. Nowhere in the remarkably clear video footage is there any evidence that Gruley assaulted Hornstein. Police spokesman Sergeant Peter Simpson offered no comment yesterday, but he did say he was planning to discuss the incident with Police Chief Larry O'Day. Ty Gruley's older brother, Giuliani, was arrested the same night for interfering with police and resisting arrest. He was convicted of those counts, but a charge of disorderly conduct was dropped. He was sentenced to 64 hours community service and 2 years probation.
Yeah, I'm Matt Cummings. I live in Portland.
Yeah, so we want to talk about the judge's ruling in the Ty Gruley case that was released yesterday. As we know, Ty Gruley was acquitted of all the charges against him, which included resisting arrest, assault on a police officer, and attempted strangulation of a police officer. But so you were at the hearing, and I was wondering, what was the Gruley family's response in the courtroom to this acquittal?
I think mostly relief. You know, there's tears and just a big sigh of relief. Was like a big celebration, you know, because they faced a lot of jail time, but they were happy, obviously. But yeah, a lot of relief that justice was done that day.
The judge also harshly criticized the behavior of the Portland police officers that were involved in the incident. Were they present at the hearing?
No, they were not.
Well, what did the judge have to say about the officers how they handled the incident?
Yeah, Judge Stewart was, I don't know if she was bewildered, but she said Hornstein's account of the case didn't match with the video evidence whatsoever. So it was really good that people got out and filmed the police when they were doing it, and luckily the U.S. bank footage was there as well. But she said that the officers' account of the case, none of them corroborated with one another, nor did they corroborate with the video evidence. And she was pretty harsh. I won't say pretty, she was very harsh on Hornstein and Hornstein's account and her citing Ty trying to strangle her. She was pretty confused how Betsy Hornstein came up with that notion.
Do you think that if there wasn't video footage of the incident, then it would have been much harder to determine the kind of incredulity of the officer's testimony?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Based on the history of Jeff America and when you deal with a teenager, it's one person's word against four officers, and if the officer's word didn't corroborate, there would be one person's word against four others. So video evidence was probably crucial.
I read that the police representative who was there, Sergeant Pete Simpson, he didn't publicly comment, but he did state that he was planning to talk to the police chief Larry O'Day about the incident. Do you personally think there will be any consequences within the department following the judge's ruling and criticism of the officers?
So I'm sure O'Day will say something that they're going to investigate it, and they'll probably Hornstein a paid vacation. You know how that goes. So that's kind of what I assume will happen. They'll say they're going to do an internal investigation, but you know the community's already done a lot of effort with the COAB, the Community Advisory Board. So he'll probably try to take credit for that, like they were already on top of this, trying to do stuff like that. But that COAB met to do their bylaws and put race in there, the community overseeing board. So those pieces are already in place, regardless of what O'Day says or not.
Right. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Matt. I appreciate the interview, man.
Yeah, and I'd just like to remind listeners that that happened on the 12th, which is the same day that folks get together on Northeast 6th and Halsey to remember Keaton Otis, who was shot 23 times by the police 5 years ago. And this coming in May, it's after March, but no, April, the five-year anniversary of that. So people show up on the corner of 6th and Halsey at 6 p.m. to remember Pete Notis and Fred Bryant, his father. That would be good.
That's on April 12th?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for that information. Yeah. That was Matt Cummings, a Portland activist, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
At Portland State University, the Community Oversight Advisory Board voted to have researchers conduct surveys to gauge the quality of relations between area residents and the Portland City Police Department. The vote was preceded by a lengthy discussion concerning the release of a similar review done back in the year 2013. Critics asserted that a lack of ethnic diversity among people who were in the survey, and others contended that ties between the researchers and the police bureau ran too deep. The city's compliance officer, Dennis Rosenbaum, who is from the University of Illinois Law School, will then analyze the gathered data. In January, the city of Portland hired Rosenbaum for a sum of $315,000 annually. That does include travel expenses. He is tasked with monitoring the police reforms mandated by a settlement between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice. That settlement followed the 2012 investigation of excessive use of force by the Portland Police Department.
59-year-old Benito Vasquez Hernandez is not only the longest-held material witness in an Oregon criminal case, but also in the United States. Vasquez Hernandez is approaching 900 days of incarceration at the Washington County Detention Center since his arrest in September 2012 after a traffic stop in San Diego, California, with his son Moises Vasquez Santiago. Both men were held initially as material witnesses and a charge each of hindering prosecution in a murder case involving Benito Vasquez Hernandez's 31-year-old son Eloy Vasquez Santiago. The charges of hindering prosecution for both men were dropped at a hearing in October 2013, but both were still detained as material witnesses. Their freedom has been offered in exchange for video depositions that would help in the prosecution of their son and brother. Moises Vasquez Santiago was released from hold last September, though he was confused and rambling in his testimony. He said Eloy had admitted murdering the woman in 2012. His father, Benito Vasquez Hernandez, however, was remanded back to custody after not being able to comprehend the situation and what was being asked of him by the court. KB was able to speak with Alan Biederman, attorney for Mr. Vasquez Hernandez. Biederman said that his client had cultural, social, and mental challenges that have prevented him from being able to comply with court's requests of a deposition. Biederman hopes that his client will be released after the beginning of the murder trial for his son Eloy, scheduled for this coming Tuesday, March 17th, in Washington County Court. Biederman also said that in his 27 years as a criminal defense attorney, this is the first time that he's represented a material witness. Oregon's statute regarding the detainment of material witnesses is one that's open-ended, though witnesses are typically held for days rather than months, and in this case for almost 2 years. Prosecution applied to the court for Vasquez Hernandez's detainment based on fear that he may not be found for testimony at the trial. Moises Vasquez Santiago has not been seen since his release after giving his video deposition.
This week, the National Bureau on Justice Statistics released the results of a study finding that the FBI has been drastically undercounting the number of police killings of unarmed civilians, possibly by as much as 50%. The study estimated that approximately 1,000 unarmed civilians are killed by the police in the United States every year. This past week has seen a number of police killings of unarmed civilians. These include the following. In Florida, a man named Derek Cruz was shot during a raid for possible marijuana possession. Last Friday in Madison, Wisconsin, a man named Anthony Robinson was killed by police, and multiple protests have taken place since then in Madison. The largest of these attracted 2,000 people. Matt Kenny, the officer who killed Robinson, had also killed another unarmed civilian back in the year 2007. He has now been placed on administrative leave. And on Thursday, an unarmed man was killed after being spotted walking in a subway tunnel in Washington, D.C. Police closed the Potomac Avenue metro station temporarily, but since then, they have reopened the station.
Several fraternities across the U.S. have faced accusations of racism for incidents that have happened over the last week. In Seattle, a fraternity at the University of Washington allegedly shouted racist slurs at African Americans marching in a Black Lives Matter demonstration as they passed the frat house in February. The fraternity is Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE, which is a branch of the same fraternity implicated in a racist video in Oklahoma. On Monday, the University of Oklahoma closed its SAE chapter after a video was uploaded online showing students from the fraternity chanting racist phrases. The school also expelled two students, who have since apologized for playing a leading role in the incident. In Washington, university officials say they're looking into claims that fraternity members hurled what they termed grossly insensitive comments and rude gestures at African-American marchers. The president of the university's Black Student Union said that people were called monkeys and apes by members of SAE. The fraternity claimed that they had already looked into it and determined that the culprits were not members of the fraternity. The university's investigation of the incident is still ongoing. Also this week, a fraternity in Maryland has come under scrutiny for a similar offense. The University of Maryland and Kappa Sigma fraternity say they're investigating an email sent by a student which was loaded with sexist and racist wording. According to WTOP, the email includes racial slurs and refers to raping Black, Indian, and Asian women during Rush Week. Last week, KABU reported that students at Washington State University sparked a national trend on Twitter with the hashtag #WakeUpAndHearMe. The campaign began after a student was told to leave the Phi Delta Theta fraternity and called racial slurs. Students said they organized the campaign not just in response to this one incident, but to highlight the challenges underrepresented students, particularly students of color, face on their college campuses.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses, hosting a conversation on the color of food at 6 o'clock. Then at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. The weather for the entire weekend will be about 53 degrees with a 90 at least percent chance of rain. Today in history, Friday the 13th of March. In the year 624, the Battle of Badr was won by the new followers of Islam. This event is known as the major turning point that led to the rise of Islam. And in 1963, Ernesto Miranda was arrested and questioned by Arizona police without being informed that he had the right to legal counsel before answering any questions. The case ultimately went to the Supreme Court of the United States and established what became known colloquially as the Miranda Rights of every American citizen. The quote for today is, "Reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled." This is attributed to Richard Feynman.
Despite the forecast of a very rainy weekend in Portland, drought continues to be a compelling topic here and on the West Coast. As the warmest winter in Oregon and Washington State since the Dust Bowl era gives way to spring, officials in both states are deciding whether to declare water emergencies. The prospect of drought in Washington and Oregon might seem strange given their reputation for overcast skies and unending drizzle. In fact, the region has seen close to average rainfall over the course of the winter. Despite those precipitation levels, what the Oregon and Washington mountains haven't seen is much of a snowpack. In Oregon, the snowpack on Mount Hood is so low there's a fear of water rationing come spring. Over the last 2 weeks, snowpack levels have been at 8% of normal on Mount Hood. Amid the worst ski season in decades, Mount Hood Ski Bowl announced yesterday that it hasn't seen a winter this bad since 1955. In western Washington, the Olympic Mountains have also had snowpack at about 8% of normal, and rivers fed by the range's glaciers are running low. The fear is that it's too late at this point for snowpack in the region to recover to anything near normal. In eastern Washington, the Walla Walla River Basin was among three areas in Washington state declared to be in drought conditions today by the governor. The picture is particularly troubling in southeast Oregon, where California's ongoing drought appears to have jumped the state line. Parts of eastern and southern Oregon have already been placed into the moderate to extreme category for drought conditions this year. At Crater Lake, the last record low for snowfall was set in 1977 at 31 inches. This year's low dropped to 28 inches. Further south, nearly 45% of California is currently experiencing severe drought conditions, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Shrinking snowpacks and early snowmelts from rising temperatures mean that the whole West Coast faces a persistent and worsening drought, as well as the threat of wildfires late in the summer.
Well, the Federal Communications Commission publicly released the new net neutrality regulation that it approved in a 3-2 vote 2 weeks ago. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler drafted much of the 400-page paper, which reclassifies broadband internet under Title II of the telecommunications law. This ensures that internet speeds cannot be unequally sped up or slowed down by internet service providers, such as Comcast, AT&T, or Verizon. AT&T has hinted at legal challenge to the new regulations, hoping that a federal judge could overturn the FCC's decision, but it seems unlikely that that will occur. With the public release of the regulations, a transparent and clear discussion can now be had concerning the details of the Title II reclassification. It is scheduled to be published in the Federal Register in a few weeks, and the new regulations will go into effect 60 days after that publication.
Swedish prosecutors have offered to question Julian Assange in London over allegations involving sexual misconduct and rape of two women. The WikiLeaks founder has been in asylum inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London for nearly 3 years now, in fear that if he were to face the charges in Sweden, he could be extradited to the U.S., where he faces investigation for his role in publishing U.S. intelligence documents. Assange denies the accusations of sexual misconduct, and he said that he wants the Swedish case to proceed so he can clear his name. The prosecutor in charge of the case has previously declined traveling to London to question Assange, saying that such an arrangement would diminish the quality of the interview. But the statute of limitations on the allegations run out in August, and in light of this time limit, she's agreed to meet Assange at the embassy. The results of the interview will determine whether the case moves forward, and subsequently whether Assange will be able to move freely once again. WikiLeaks, which continues to publish documents in Assange's absence, has been hailed for its role in forcing greater transparency upon the military and intelligence communities around the world.
Civil liberties groups across the nation of Canada are taking part in a day of action tomorrow to oppose a sweeping bill that will provide unprecedented surveillance powers for Canada's National Security Service. Over 83,000 people have filed online comments in opposition to the bill known as C-51. Tomorrow, all across Canada, a diverse network of organizations are participating in actions opposing Bill C-51. Their main concerns are that the bill, if passed, will turn Canada's National Security Service into a secret police force with little oversight or accountability. It will allow for the censorship of free expression online, and it authorizes dragnet-type surveillance and information sharing on all Canadian citizens. For more on this, Cable's Jenka Soderberg spoke with David Christopher of Open Media, which is located in Vancouver, Canada.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the bill C-51 that is being considered in Canada right now.
This bill C-51 is one of the most reckless pieces of legislation, I think, ever introduced by a Canadian government. It amounts to the most sweeping expansion of the surveillance state in Canadian history, really. And it's really brought Canadians together, I think, from right across the political spectrum to work together and stand up together to try to put a stop to this bill. The personal information of Canadians could be collected and shared between 17 government departments and even handed over to foreign governments and potentially to the US NSA. So I think it's no surprise that Canadians are really concerned about this bill. And we're all coming together tomorrow with over 55 actions now planned right across Canada from Vancouver to Toronto and further afield. So we're gearing up for that as we speak.
And the bill is being touted as an anti-terrorism bill that is attempting to provide more surveillance and more ability for government officials to go after people who are suspected of being involved in that kind of activity. Do you feel that that is not the intent of the law, or that it's not going to be effective in doing that?
Oh, absolutely. This bill certainly won't be effective in doing that. You know, the kind of dragnet surveillance mechanisms that this bill would lead to have simply been proven ineffective in helping make the country or any country more secure. You simply can't just collect private information on everybody and expect that that will somehow make the country safer. And I think that argument has gotten increasingly discredited now. You know, Canada, unfortunately, has a very conservative government that for years has been trying to trample on Canadians' privacy rights. They've tried a number of times to do so. Previously in the past, we've succeeded in forcing them to change course. I'm hoping that we can do the same with this legislation. But, you know, even if they do force it through Parliament, where they have a majority here, you know, we've got a federal election later on this year, and certainly this is shaping up to be a real issue, a really major issue, and many of the Conservatives' own grassroots supporters are very unhappy about these kind of privacy intrusions and the power that this would give the government over the private lives of citizens.
And are there similarities then with the USA Patriot Act that was used by the NSA here in the United States to conduct dragnet surveillance of citizens?
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate analogy, actually. You know, some of Canada's top privacy experts have analyzed this bill, and that's actually the comparison that they came up with as well, that this does, you know, they're not identical, but in terms of the effect that it would have on our democracy, I think it certainly is comparable with the negative impact that the Patriot Act has had down in the United States. So certainly that's not something I think that Canadians want to have here. I think that's why we've seen, and it's really quite a palpable sense of momentum now right across the country as Canadians come together around this. So certainly we're really looking forward to tomorrow and looking forward to sending the Prime Minister a message that he can't ignore.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that information with us. I've been speaking with David Christopher. He's with Open Media, their website, openmedia.ca. They're part of a national movement in Canada to oppose a bill called C-51 that the group say is actually going to be extremely detrimental to civil liberties in the country. And tomorrow, on Saturday, there will be nonpartisan events in over 55 locations in every province in Canada opposing this bill. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
This Sunday marks the third anniversary of the U.S.-Korean Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. According to advocacy group Public Citizen, it's cost Americans 85,000 jobs. The pact was promoted as a way to create jobs and expand exports, but the U.S. trade deficit with Korea has instead soared. The recently published data assessing the negative impact of CAFTA raises questions about President Obama's efforts to fast-track the upcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The TPP is a massive free trade deal that would involve the U.S. and 11 Pacific Rim nations and would affect roughly 40% of the world's economy. All negotiations shaping the TPP have taken place in highly secret meetings with no transparency or input from the public or non-corporate advocacy groups. The limited information that's available to the public has been leaked, but indicates that the trade agreement would loosen labor laws, establish corporate authority in regional lawsuits, water down environmental regulation, and prioritize corporate monopolies over economic diversity.
The former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, has been sentenced to 13 years in prison on so-called terrorism charges for firing a judge while he was president. Nasheed was forced out of office in the year 2012 in what he said was a military coup. Thousands of people took to the streets to protest the coup, but they were attacked by government forces. When he was elected in the year 2008, Nasheed was the nation's first democratically elected leader. His election ended 3 decades of military dictatorship. Nasheed became a worldwide campaigner against climate change. He made a tearful plea to the United Nations as the Maldives, an island location located south of India, began to sink underwater. In February, the new government had him arrested and found him guilty of ordering the arrest of a judge while he was in office. Those charges were then dropped, and he was then rearrested and charged under anti-terrorism laws, but no specific charges were made against the former president. Today, Nasheed was sentenced to 13 years in prison on unspecified terrorism charges with no evidence presented in the case.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-